All right. Thank you so much for having me today. This is what I think. When I was asked to speak about tonight, and to be honest, I didn't really. There's just so much that's been said about the U.S. election. It's obscene. There's so much every day. I can't open my mouth in a gas station or a taxi or Uber without people saying, oh, where are you from and who's going to win? And that's, you know, that's happened for years. It used to be, oh, where are you from and is Hillary going to run? So the U.S. election has, for years writ large, but nothing like the last 4 years. And I mean, I guess the one good thing is that Trump has led probably to the salvation of a lot of news outlets, and that people will actually pay for the New York Times and the Washington Post and The Economist and other thoughtful news providers, as well as the people who pay for the ones that aren't so thoughtful. So this is kind of, though, it's what I thought I would focus on for a couple of minutes or 20 minutes, is kind of how we got here and some of the things that even I have learned. So as you've heard, I represented the United States overseas for about 25 years. I retired early. I always say I'm grateful to Donald Trump for one thing. I no longer wake up and say, gee, I so miss representing the United States overseas. It's sad. It's sad. I became an Australian citizen, so thank you to all of you for welcoming me so graciously. But I've maintained my U.S. citizenship as well. So I think this is this crazy situation that the United States has that is a very expensive ritual in which a small number, and I mean, we're talking maybe 180,000 people in 2016 who swung the election to the result we ended up having. So why is that? And I thought we'd just step back a little bit and look at, okay, there we go, to look that way. So how does the president get in the office? And, I mean, it is quite a crazy system. It really is. And Gordon and I were talking the other day, so I hope you weren't going to plan to use this line because I'm stealing it. And Gordon said, oh, we are so proud of ourselves because we have the oldest constitution that's still in place in the world. He said, how many products are out there that have a user manual that's 200 years old? And I think that's just such an incredibly important thing to keep in mind, because many Americans will swear that that's a fabulous thing. It's kind of like the Anglican Church, where I spend a lot of my time and energy, you know, that people say, I come to church because it's the same liturgy that it's been for 400 years. I'm like, yeah, I'm sure Jesus said something about that in the Bible somewhere. I just haven't found it yet. So the important thing is to remember that we are very much bound by our Constitution. And our Constitution, okay, was set up around a bunch of states. Now, not this many states when it was founded, when we were founded. So can you see those numbers? I'm afraid you can't. All right, so that's the population of each state. So as you can see, we go from California and the West Coast. Most of our population, like so many countries, the population is lined up along the coasts. So you can see California has 40 million people, nearly. Florida has 21 million. If you add up all those states along the eastern seaboard, they account for an awful lot. Then you get to where I'm from, which is right about here, at the top of that two. And we have 2.9 million. To be honest, that's more than I thought. They're actually, I live in the western part of the state. I'm from the western part of the state. We have fewer people living in the High Plains today than we did in the 1860s when California became a state and the land was open, so-called opened up, when the land was taken from the Indians or the Native Americans and people like my ancestors got to settle it. So you can see this huge difference. But each of those state entities have an individual standing. The lowest population is 570,000 in Wyoming compared to Florida's 40 million. Alaska has 730,000. So it's quite a big difference. So now we think about, okay, Robin, now we know more about the U.S. population and how it's divvied up. But why does that mean we have to endure all these years and months of U.S. election coverage? Well, it's because our Constitution includes an electoral college. And each state gets a certain number of electoral votes. Now, that number of electoral votes is two, the number of representatives that each state has in Congress. So the Senate, each state gets two votes. And then the House of Representatives is determined by the population. So the smallest number of electoral votes a state can have is three, right? So you get this sort of skew that it works out that 4% of the state populations, states with 4% of the population total control 8% of the electoral votes. So that's a start. So it's also important to remember that this year we're still having to deal with the 2010 census. So the census is a very political issue. And funnily enough, the 2020 census didn't get published in time to be used for this election. Am I right? Yeah. All right. So now, an even bigger factor skewing the outcome of the election is that the electoral votes per state are awarded to whomever gets the plurality of the vote. So you can get the highest number by one vote, and your entire state's electoral votes go to that candidate. And if you've got third-party candidates running, as Ralph Nader did against Gore, then that can completely skew it. So the other candidate, and I can probably bet you that most Ralph Nader voters would not have preferred Bush to get in. But that meant that Bush got Florida's electoral votes and a whole bunch of little details like hanging chads as well. So all of those, basically, if you're the 50.0001% vote in your state and anybody above you, those votes really don't count. So that's why Hillary Clinton lost the election. She managed to get nearly 3 million more popular votes than Donald Trump, but they weren't in places that made a big difference. So now, I want to look at this slide that shows, whoops, that's not right. That slide shows the result of the 2016 election. Obviously, the blue states voted Democrat, voted for Hillary, went to Hillary. And this is also important for their Senate seats, which we're going to talk about later. So keep in mind, we're not only talking about the presidency. So all of these states, it looks like the entire middle of the United States is red, that no one voted, that it's like this huge block of Republican votes. And this is what the consensus looks like right now, for all the different polls. So obviously the lighter shades mean we're not quite certain, but it's probably going to go Republican or blue, dark blue. But so you can see these brown ones are the ones that are sort of felt like they're too close to call right now. Those are what we call swing states. But I think all of these maps do us a bit of a disservice because they make it look like it's so cut and dried. They make it look like everybody in Texas, you know, all the swath of everybody who lives in the middle of the United States is going to vote one way, and the ones who live on the coast are going to vote another. Now, this is, I actually think, a really useful one because this depiction tells us more about what's happening on the ground. So you see significantly blue areas, which are maybe mainly urban centers. And those can be in states which ended up going red on the maps you saw before. So one study showed that in the 2012 election, for example, there was a 66% correlation between voting Democratic and living in an area with more than 800 people per square mile. Didn't matter where in the country that was. Below 800 people per square mile, a 66% chance that the vote was Republican. But even more important is this big white area. Look at that. What does that tell you?
It tells you dust doesn't vote. And I can say that because I come from the dust. Mountains don't vote. Deserts don't vote.
So it's not only that those, we've got this electoral map, which is, seems to be going to go one way or going to go the other way. But we've got a country in which basically 40% of it, in terms of land mass, really doesn't even count. So when I think about how we get people engaged and how elections happen and all this hullabaloo, there's a lot of us who feel pretty irrelevant. Now, this might be a good chance to say, good time to say, how many of you are, anybody in here who's an Eagles supporter? Can you raise your hand? I promise I won't tell anyone. Only one? Oh my God. Okay, Jim, I applaud your honesty. Anybody who's a Dockers supporter? Oh my gosh, how did this happen? Now, what?
Correlation between education.
What would it take you Dockers supporters to shift you to being Eagles supporters? Anything? Could anything happen? All right. So if I talk to people in the United States, people in my hometown, honestly, our hired man who works on our my family's farm, actually said to me once, Robin, you're not saying you're a Democrat, are you? And it's just as ingrained. So we say, how could people vote for Trump? And unfortunately, in the 2016 election, what we had was an election in which, for better or worse, there were many, many voters, Democratic voters, who couldn't bring themselves to vote for Hillary Clinton. Personally, I think that's unfair. I've worked for her. I think she's a great person. But that was the way the situation was. So back to these nodules of votes. People across the country are spread out in different ways. Another thing I want to mention is, you can blame John, by the way, for all these maps, because I said, I don't know what I'm going to say. He said, you should bring a map. Yeah, right. All right, so this is a map in 2016 of who voted, voting saturation, voting levels. So the darker green it is, the higher percentage voted. And the brown and the taupe, so the dark brown means very, very low turnout, under 40-some percent. So I had edited this slide because originally the thing I downloaded from the Washington Post just said who showed up. But what it really means is not only who bothered to show up, but who was able to show up. And to me, this is so telling because if you look at that SWAT in certain areas, some of them are huge land masses, so there probably wasn't a voting area, voting polling station close by. Remember, in the United States, we don't have compulsory voting. We don't get a day off. People right now who are doing early voting in areas which are considered to be well-run are standing in line for an hour and a half to 2 hours in the cold. But we have a real situation in which Republican-controlled Senate, state legislatures and other issues, legal cases, have managed to make it harder and harder for people in certain areas to vote. And so this brown you see coming up is a combination of both of those things. For example, there are cases before the Supreme Court, and we just have a new Chief Justice who will be voting on this, as well as the existing sitting justices. Right now there's a case that says that they approved that there can be only, it's okay if there's only one place to drop off your ballot per county in Texas. Now, some of those Texas counties are pretty darn big, like 150 miles wide. And former Senator Heidi Heitkamp of South Dakota, so second from the top in the middle, see that big square right up? That's probably an Indian reservation, because she was one of the few Democrats elected from that whole, a senator from that whole strip. And funnily enough, she lost her seat because the state house, which was controlled by the Republican Party, I introduced something that said you have to have a physical address to be able to register to vote. And most Indians who live on reservations don't have addresses. There's no specific address. So it's important. It makes a difference. Now, in the last election, we had about 58% of eligible voters voted. Huh? 59. Which sounds terrible. But I'll remind you that in Australia, where voting is compulsory and you do get the day off to vote, only about 82% of people vote. So this year, we already have, with early voting, more than 70 million have voted as of when I walked in tonight. And so it looks like we could have considerably more than the 137 million who voted 4 years ago could be voting. How those votes are going to be counted in time and whether they'll be counted efficiently and effectively is a very good question. So I want to go back to this projection slide, the one that could tell us, if you look at the number, you have to have they have to have 270 electoral votes to win. This was yet last night, the projections, that Biden has roughly 290. Because I think this helps me explain that rather stroppy comment on my title slide about expensive, very expensive, and effort that really only targets a few people, small number of people who are going to make a difference. Now, as I said, I think American voting standards or habits are a bit Dockers Eagles-esque, but we vote the way our parents did, we vote the way we think our friends do. The perceived personalities make a difference, and goodness knows that should happen this year. But we can't be sure that's going to be the case. And when I vote in Kansas, I could have been pretty certain that my vote one way or another wasn't going to really have a difference. I'm amazed that they don't show Kansas as bright red on that. Kansas, I'm nearly certain, will go for Trump as a state. We may, though, elect one Democratic senator, but it's a long shot. So I knew my vote wasn't going to make a difference. Now I vote in Texas, and that's probably the case as well. And it really wouldn't matter if I vote blue or I vote red, because if the difference is, if it's more than 50%, your vote doesn't matter. But these cases where we've got the brown squares, the brown color, now that makes a difference. And the candidates see it that way too. $11 billion has been spent on this national campaign, not just the presidential campaign. This is the other seats as well. All federal seats, $11 billion. $1 billion has been spent on TV ads. More than $1 billion has been spent on TV ads relevant to the presidential race. So they're not going to commit those funds in places that they know are already going to go one way or another. Right? They're going to commit them like this. Remember I talked to you about I'm from Kansas. It's called the flyover country. Talk about the flyover country. Yeah, so the middle is up now. People in the middle are probably really grateful right now because they're not being bombarded quite as much. Somebody I know who was in Florida told me that in a half-hour show they saw 8 different political ads. In a half-hour show. The math I did roughly on the back of an envelope shows that between the two campaigns, they're spending $30 per eligible voter on campaign ads. In presidential campaign ads in Florida. This doesn't count the Senate. So that's 50% higher. That $11 billion is 50% higher than the amount that was spent in 2016. So I focus most of my time this evening on the Electoral College and how the presidential candidates address this, how that it's likely to shape out, and why in the Electoral College. But I think it's also really important. And today's or yesterday's confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett while the election was going on as a Supreme Court Justice. Now remember, our Supreme Court Justices serve for life. She's in her 50s? late 40s. Yeah. So that's a long time. And the ironic thing is that she's replacing Ruth Bader Ginsburg. So it's really like a bucket of cold water, I guess. So it compels me to raise an even more important issue than the Electoral College and the presidency. And that's the Senate. So these squares represent how many votes each senator had to get to be elected. All right? So we've got Kamala Harris, who has the most of anyone who's in the Senate right now. She's two senators from California for 40 million, population of 40 million. Kamala Harris had 3.5 million votes or something like that, around that. And because her opponent was, because of California's weird laws, was also a Democrat, the Democrats actually got 7 million votes in California that year to put Kamala Harris in the Senate. This guy, Michael Indy, I think his name is, from Wyoming, he got 117,000 votes. But their vote in the Senate is equally strong. Now, it's not only Republicans who represent small states. There's a lot of small squares around that are blue as well. But one estimate shows that one party could get only 17% of the popular vote across the country and still control the Senate. 1-7. Because of this system of each state having two senators, and of course a majority or the plurality in the state wins. So all of that matters. It matters a lot because the Senate is hugely, hugely important. I think much more so than in a lot of countries have this not one vote, one value in their upper house. But we have it in the House that controls every presidential appointment, every judiciary appointment at the federal level, and as again, those are for life. They have to approve all of the legislation. So the House and the Senate both have to approve all legislation. So these are just a couple of things that have come up in the recent years with a Senate that is clearly not in line with the general U.S. public's views. I guess that's a bit of a stretch to say that. So it matters because it was Congress that was designed by the Founding Fathers to be a check on absolute power by the executive branch and the judiciary was also considered to be a check on executive power and on congressional power. But when you have this situation where all of these things are working in tandem, those checks and balances become completely ineffective. And the result is a one-party steroid, a one-party system on steroids, which is kind of what I think we're seeing right now, with ramifications far in the future. So that's not going to change. The equal states representation in the Senate is the only thing that is spelled out in the Constitution that it cannot be changed unless every state that will be affected agrees. What do you think the odds of that happening are? So I guess what I'm saying is we should be concerned about the presidential election, and it's fun, and it is incredibly important, but it's fun to think about, and it's incredibly important. But this is important across the U.S. political system. And if you know anybody who can vote and who hasn't yet, please tell them to get with it. And that's it, especially if you're from one of those flyover states like I am. Thanks.
Well, that's fabulous, Robin. Thanks very much. A real deep dive into how it works and gives us a much better understanding of what's happening. With that, I wonder if I can ask...
Just call me Kim.
I've done it again. Thanks very much. With that, while we're digesting that excellent deep dive. Thanks so much. If I can hand over to Gordon to take us to the next phase. Thanks very much, Gordon.
Well, thank you. It's clear that I'm going to have to yield my professorial title to Robin. Well, that was spectacular. I appreciate it very much. Let me also begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet, the Noongar people, of the Wajak people, rather, of the Noongar Nation, and pay my respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. As introduced, I was born and raised as a 1% white minority in the middle of America. My father taught primary school on the Navajo Indian Reservation, and so for the first 18 years of my life, that's all I knew. And when I first arrived in Australia, I have to confess, and I heard this welcome to country, and at someone's recommendation, I watched tearfully the amazing sorry speech given by Kevin Rudd about the lost generations. I was really impressed in thinking that Australia was far ahead of where the United States was. And in some respects, we are, right? In other respects, you know, candidly, 7 years in, I still love the idea of an acknowledgement of country. It's a great thing. But the fact that it has become kind of rote and we don't think about the next generation things, I had anticipated that I would spend a lot of my time engaging on these issues, given my passion. And as you might imagine, the opportunity to do that in Perth or even here at UWA is extremely limited in that process. And the reason I think I wanted to start with that is that on election night in 2016, I was shattered, right? It was the first and the only time in my life that I've ever cried at a political development. And let me tell you why. Number one, you may recall, many of you were there. We hosted an election watch event here at the University Club downstairs where 400 of my closest friends watched me melt down over the course of the day. For a week, people, strangers, would walk up to me in downtown Perth and say, Gordon, do you need a hug? Apparently, they knew my religious background because apparently Robin got, do you need a drink? I didn't get that, right, in terms of the process, right? But, you know, over the course of a day, just doing media after media after media, and just the enormity of it all and the shock of it all, it was beginning to wear into me. And that evening, Rob and I were on ABC Drive, and somebody called up from Bassendean and gave his name and said, I'd like to invite you all to a Make Australia Great Again party. He laughed, I laughed. And then this gentleman proceeded to talk about how white power was on the march in Australia too, and that the Saxons would rise, right? And it just struck me that here I am, on the farthest city in the planet on land, away from Washington, D.C., and the manner in which Donald Trump campaigned empowered this Yahoo in Bassendean to think it was okay to call a radio station and give his name and neighborhood and spout racist bile, right? And so I get home and hear my wife. My wife was a refugee from Laos, right? You know, and the mere thought of the Obamas who we revered turning over the keys of the White House to this crass, profane creature was just too much to bear. We both just melt into tears, right? And yet, I was blissfully naive at that point as to how bad things would be today, 4 years later. So let me start off with full disclosure. Number one, I was wrong in 2016. You know, I was not alone in being wrong in 2016. I will tell you that on Election Day, we will not be having a big election watch event here at University Club. I will be in a fetal position under my bed at home on the process. But also, I think it's important for you to understand where I stand on these issues. Because when it analyzes politics in this highly bifurcated world, even here in Australia, whether you're liberal or labor, we're tending, I think, far too much towards that kind of red state, blue state mentality as well. I'm from Arizona. Arizona traditionally was as a Republican as they come. I was a lifelong Republican. I voted for George H.W. Bush. I voted for George W. Bush. I was a solid block Republican voter until 2004. I voted for John Kerry, despite the fact that I think John Kerry is a bit of an arrogant, I can't say that on the camera. He's a bit arrogant, shall we say, right? But that was a protest Bush vote against George W. Bush for his inability to have any introspection about the Iraq War, his inability to change. And by the time 2008 came around, I joined the Obama campaign's Asia team as a Republican. And I asked the campaign, do you want me to change my registration because I'm registered as a Republican? And they said, no, we're postpartisan. We love Obamacans. You know, come on board. And by 2010, I changed my registration to independent because I could no longer abide what the Republican Party had become. So I'm telling you this just to say that I'm not, you know, a screaming liberal on the Democratic side of politics, but as someone who has spent my entire professional career in think tanks and in foreign policy community, where it is essential that I play both sides, right? It's essential for me today in Australian politics that all my genuine friends and partners on the liberal side of politics think that I lean liberal, and the people on the labor side of politics think that I lean labor, because, again, the truth is, in Australia, it just doesn't matter nearly to the same degree it does in the United States, right? It's just not that big of a divide, right? The entire Australian political spectrum, with the exception of Pauline Hanson, would fit squarely in the Democratic Party, right? It really is. That the entire spectrum. It's not that big a difference, right? Well, yeah, we'll get back to that in terms of the process. Yeah, Peter Dutton might hang out with Pauline Hanson. That's another story altogether, right? But having said that, right, under Donald Trump, despite my lifelong proclivity to be careful and not to be overly partisan, I never wanted anyone to doubt where I stood. To me, it wasn't a political issue. It wasn't a machinization in terms of my personal institutional interest. It was a moral question, right? And so I don't think there's anyone who has been to a Perth US Asia Center event for the last 4 years that doubts what my views on Donald Trump are. And again, I was blissfully naive 4 years ago about where we could be today. So that's where I stand, right? And I'm pretty clear about that. Now, having said all of that, I am more optimistic about the results in the 2016 election in 1 week. 1 week from today, we should know, right? Than I have been at any point in the last 4 years, right? Yeah, in 2016, right? So the 2020 election today, where we are today, right? So let me just tell you a couple of insights on that front, right? If it had not been for our shared trauma of 2016, nobody would be calling this election close. There's nothing to suggest that it's remotely close, right? It's only that nagging thing in the back of our heads after the 2016 that's got nobody willing to say it. So it's the inverse of the emperor's new clothes, right? Nobody is willing to say it. No one is willing to say that Biden is fully dressed and Trump is naked, right? Because we're scarred by that experience, right? So to put this in context, the defining feature of the entire 4-year Trump presidency has been how robust the numbers have been. So after the very first week of his presidency, his approval rating has been a shockingly robust 40% approval rating. His disapproval rating has been a shockingly robust 50% disapproval rating. He has been underwater for 10% his entire presidency. There has not, there have been ups and downs, 1 or 2%, right, depending on the issues. And again, I use the word shocking because for people outside the spectrum, it's very difficult to understand why in the world Trump's support doesn't fall. And again, this is where I thought Robin's analogy to an eagle stalker thing makes perfect sense. I was in a round table with Charlie Cook, who was the dean of American Political Observers about 2 weeks ago. And Charlie Cook says, something can't fall unless it has risen. Donald Trump's approval ratings never rose. They never went above 50%. They've always been at 40%. It's like waiting for your pre-shrunk jeans to shrink. They've already shrunk it. It is what it is, right? That's the nature of it is, right? And so the other thing which has been just remarkably consistent is a stubborn 10% gap between approval rating of Biden and Donald Trump. 10%. It was that 10% gap that led Trump to get impeached, that tried to sully him with Ukraine, that leads to him today doing everything he can to throw things at Biden, and it hasn't budged. We have been talking now for 2 months about how when the election gets closer, that gap is going to close. It's going to close. It's going to close. And it's going to close. This morning, Nate Silver, many of you may follow him, and Brendan and I were talking about it this morning. Nate Silver used to work for the New York Times. He's like a numbers nerd of all numbers nerds. He doesn't just do polling. What he does is he amalgamates all high-quality polls released nationally, and he gives them weights based on, you know, the sample size, based on the type of questions, based on their historic predictability, whether they've been right or wrong, based on a whole range of issues. And then from that amalgamated, you know, collection of polls, he has an average across the way. So it's not just one single poll, right? So something comes out from Fox News. If it comes from the news side, he's going to give it more weight. If it comes, you know, from Rasmussen, he's going to give it less weight because they tend to be highly partisan, right? So he's going to do that on both sides of it. So I read something just today from Nate Silver that since the last presidential debate, there have been 34 high-quality polls, and they have showed that the race has tightened 0.1%. It's not changing, right? And the reason it's not changing is there's nobody that's undecided, right? The notion that there's an undecided voter, that somebody says, I don't know what I feel about Donald Trump right now. I mean, he is in your face every day, all day long. You know, the notion that you can escape this maelstrom is gone. As a result, you know, they're so robust, right? And again, if I go back to something that Robin said, what shocked us and where we all got it wrong in 2016, we all know it now, is in what we used to call the blue wall. And when Rob and I were on a panel, again, 4 years ago and a week from today, right? We were confident that Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, Rust Belt, Labor, Democratic states, they would hold. They did not. You know, 77,000 votes, 0.08% of the electorate in those three states, had they gone the other direction, we would have had the inverse result, right? And the reason we missed it is because nobody was polling in those states, because nobody cared about those states, because those states were solid blue, and the polling that was done was wrong. It overweighted college-educated people who had cell phones and who responded, right? Well, pollsters are professionals, right? Nate Silver, to be honest, got it right. In the end, he predicted that Hillary Clinton would win the popular vote nationally by about 3%. And she won the popular vote nationally by about 3%, right? You know, so that's, you know, that it wasn't outside the margin of error. You know, we have this narrative that we somehow completely missed it. We didn't. It was, you know, it was a straight flush that Trump got where everything had to line up, from the Comey letter to a whole range of issues to two historically unpopular opponents. Joe Biden has never been as unpopular as Hillary Clinton was, and nothing that the president throws at him sticks. And on top of that, there's a small matter of COVID, right? So anyway, long story short, I could once again be wrong. There is still, according to Nate Silver's estimates, about a 12% chance that Donald Trump will win, which is far better than the 33% chance that he gave him winning last time. But I'll take 1 in 10 odds, which to me, again, are unacceptably high, before, you know, 1 in 3 odds any day in terms of that process. So there are still pathways for Donald Trump. But in the end, it's not nearly as close as you might think. And one of the reasons you think it is because there's not a single Democratic, you know, pollster, campaigner, candidate, political leader out there who wants anybody to do anything other than to feel sheer terror and anxiety. Because the United States does not have mandatory voting, they need to motivate people to get out. And the moment the Democratic Party thinks, yeah, this is in the bag, we don't have to go out, you know, then you get a 2016-like outcome. So the number one factor behind the 2016 election was apathy. That's it. The number one factor. So while there was a 59% turnout, that gap came from people who turned out for Donald Trump, right? So historically, for the last 50 years, every year from 1945 onward, when they began to count these types of things, the percentage of the electorate that were white males had decreased, right? And Donald Trump did something that had never happened before just by his use of anxiety and racism and straight out, again, approach. He reversed that trend and that number went up, you know. What that means is that despite the fact that everybody here probably has this consensus that Hillary Clinton ran a horrible campaign, she won more votes than any white man in history. The only person ever to win more votes than Hillary Clinton was Barack Obama twice. But the people who turned out for Barack Obama did not turn out for her. Had they turned out, she would have won hands down. It wouldn't even have been close, right? Yeah, and so I think right now, one of the reasons why you get this anxiety is because they want to make sure that we don't have the same thing happen in 2020. So now, if I'm wrong, we have far bigger problems than my credibility. But let me talk about some of the areas where I think there is some anxiety to have, right? This is not a debate in terms of two visions. America has spoken. They spoke in 2016 and they spoke again in terms of the majority of the population is not represented by Donald Trump. You know, the deplorables, you know, what now Biden has called them chump, they do not represent the America that I know and love, the neighborhoods in which I grew up in, right? You know, that's not the that's not the majority of Americans, given the system. And Robin did a great job of explaining it. That's the America we have now in terms of leadership. But the majority has long gone in the other direction. The real question is, will the efforts of the minority to suppress the vote of the majority, right, to make it difficult for the majority to vote, to, you know, through all sorts of artifices, you know, and again, Robin did a great job of explaining that, you know, steal essentially, you know, power in that process. Will they be successful or not? And the real anxiety I think people rightfully have is that in the era of COVID, questions about people being out to vote, et cetera, you know, their ability to get out, the numbers, that just becomes more and more difficult all the time, right? So that's how I would frame the debate. In a fair, open, one person, one vote, Democrat versus Republican, it's just not even close. Yeah. The reason we're having this discussion is because it is close because of the way the system has been designed to work against that, right? Now, that leads me to a longer-term area of concern, and that is a growing mantra that you hear on the left of American politics about minority rules, right? And a growing trend within the Republican Party that they say increasingly America is not a democracy and America was never intended to be a democracy. America was designed to avoid the tyranny of the majority. We have a republic. Not, you know, we're not a pure, you know, ancient Greek-style democracy. And you can understand why they're saying that, right? Because they're trying to rationalize and justify what Robin was talking about in the Supreme Court, what she was talking about in terms of gerrymandering the districts, what she was talking about in terms of the Electoral College, all these things that are designed specifically to resist majoritarianism in terms of the process. That is going to be an area of great contestation going forward. The other thing that's going to be really important for me to watch on election night a week from today, right, is how quickly the votes come in, how clearly they come in. And there has long been great anxiety about something called a red mirage. And that is because, again, of what Robin was talking about, because it's hard to vote and deliberately made hard to vote, the only people who are likely to be able to vote in person are those people who can afford to take off work and get to the polls and wait in line during a work day when it's not a holiday. You know, and those tend to skew a lot older. They tend to skew a lot whiter. And they tend to skew a lot more Republican. So as the early returns come in on election day, there is a risk that it will look like a very strong Trump turnout. Is only when those now massive amounts, historic amounts of mail-in ballots start to be counted that you're going to get the real impact of it. And we saw this in 2018. 2018 gives me great hope. There was a higher level of voter turnout in the midterm elections in 2018 than in 104 years. The last time we saw that was 1914, right? And that level of turnout. So, you know, the notion that particularly Democratic base is less motivated in 2020 than they are in 2018 doesn't make any sense to me at all. I see that coming out. So the question is just the interregnum. Now, my anxiety about that red mirage, you know, leading to instability and Trump saying, I'm declaring victory, which is not how the American system works, right? You don't declare victory. You know, the victory is determined county by county, state by state, as they declare the results. You know, that is eased by the way the map is looking right now. Those six states that really matter, and they're not exactly the same ones as the swing states, but that really matter, Florida, Pennsylvania, Arizona, Colorado, Michigan, Wisconsin, those six states, all of them require ballots to be returned by Election Day. They all have the capacity to count all their mail-in ballots on Election Day. They just put the resources to it. And there's a lot of question about whether or not they're doing that, in which states they are. Donald Trump at this point must win both Florida and Pennsylvania to have any pathway. Even if he wins Florida and Pennsylvania, which he won both last time, he still doesn't guarantee himself the presidency, right? But he must win both those. And so on election night, a week from today, if he loses either of those, it's over. There is no pathway, right? And I'm hopeful that that will enable some clarity in terms of the process, because both of those states will have the ballots in hand on election day, and they will close early. So again, this is one of the things where you're just fingers and toes crossed that it's not a long, drawn-out, week-long counting. Because the one state that most people are anxious about because they can get their ballots in long after Election Day is California. And California, you know, is, you know, there's no question about which way California goes. And so they can keep counting for years. And that's just good. It doesn't really matter in terms of the outcome there, right? Now, let me move on, because I've already gone on too long. And I'm just going to make a couple short points, and we can answer the rest of it in a question-answer period. I'm going to just talk briefly about implications for Australia, then implications for the region. Yeah, you will have been treated in the last week alone to a growing debate within Australia about what this means from Australia. Not surprisingly, the Murdoch media is already in there with, believe it or not, Trump is better for Australia. So you had this shocking op-ed in The Australian by Greg Sheridan, you know, saying, you know, because of, you know, climate change, you know, and other issues, if Biden wins, there can be immediate conflict. And so in the end, Trump has been good for us. Now, I'll be the first to admit that Australia has gotten off relatively free compared to almost every other American ally and every other country in the world. You know, one, we have a trade deficit with the United States. We spend more than 2% of our budget on defense. You know, we're the gold star, right? And successive prime ministers and ambassadors have done a really good job of keeping our heads low. So meanwhile, while NATO takes the hits and Canada takes the hits and, you know, Korea takes the hits and Japan takes the hit, you know, Australia, we've gotten off okay, right? But that's not the same thing as the saying it's good for us, right? It makes no sense to me. I'm far more persuaded by an op-ed this week in the Sydney Morning Herald by Michael Fullilove, who runs the Lowy Institute, where he basically says Australia benefits from an end to all this insanity, right? And this is the way I frame it. You know, we are a small population, 25 million people. So how does a small population, you know, of 25 million people in an immediate region of almost 3 billion people guarantee our national sovereignty and security? Well, in addition to our own very capable but very small armed services, we've long had two basic strategies. Number one, rely upon an alliance relationship with a great power far away, originally the UK, but for the last 75 years, the United States, right? And the second strategy has been rules-based order. Rules-based order. This is our national mantra, right? Australians tend to be more full-throated multilateralists than almost any other country in the world. Why? Because if you're a small country of 25 million people, you don't want to live in a world where might makes right. You want to live in a world where there's the rule of law. So you support international trade agreements, institutions, organizations, the rules-based order. And for the last 4 years, we've had this bizarre situation where one arm of our national security strategy is attacking the second arm, right? You know, where Donald Trump has been trashing the rules-based order, pulling out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, threatening the World Trade Organization, pulling out of the Paris Accords, right? You know, in general, in his America First approach to alliances like NATO and everything else, you know, doing as much damage as he possibly can to the rules-based order. So the notion somehow that, you know, there's any question about what's in Australia's interests is insane to me, right? It's a clear-cut answer that Biden's going to have some real difficult problems, right? But in the end, you know, in terms of Australia's positioning, identity, interest in the world, I tend to think that the outcome that I predict is hands down in Australia's national interest. Now, the last point I'll make, because I've already gone on way too long, is the Indo-Pacific more broadly. I'll just give you a brief advertisement on this. We're going to have one big public program. It'll be online on the 8th of November, which is a week from this coming Monday. Almost a full week after the election. By then we think we'll know it. Where we've got, you know, Ambassador Chan Heng Chi, 17 years as Singapore's ambassador to Washington, Dean of the Diplomatic Corps, Dino Patty Jalal, former Indonesian ambassador to Washington, Fujisaki Ichiro, former Japanese ambassador to Washington, D.C., Suhasina Haider, you know, diplomatic editor of the Hindu in Delhi, and Melissa Babbage, who you may know is Joe Hockey's wife, now vice chair of the American Australian Association back in Sydney, all kind of looking at the Indo-Pacific reaction to the election. And obviously, I was walking through a planning session with my team today, and I said, if I'm wrong and Donald Trump wins, then I am not attending. I said, I will not moderate that discussion because I don't think I'll have the fortitude to do it. But mercifully, I don't think that's going to be a choice that I have to make. I'm optimistic. And again, I've gone on far too long. Hopefully that gives us some fodder for the conversation.
I think you're telling people about the 7th as well. We're
reprising.
We're getting back together.
So Jeff Hutchison, who is one of the host of ABC Drive on ABC Radio, is doing something at the WA State Library called Disruption, or State of Disruption, Disrupted. And it'll be myself and Robin and Ben Riley, another professor here at UWA, and several others, I think. And Sumina Yasmin, also here, professor at University. And that'll be a public program. So just Google any of our names, or that should be an interesting event.
It's actually at the Convention Center, I think. It's 4:30 or something.
Robin is far more on top of these things than I.
So I have, like,
thanks very much, Gordon. Well, thanks, Gordon. Thanks, Robin. We now have time for Q&A. And just ask, because we podcast and vodcast, everyone's up with vodcasting? That means you can see us as well. These presentations, we will ask if you wouldn't mind using the microphone so another audience can hear. So do we have any questions for our two speakers? I watched you all spell everything they had to say. Do I see any hands up there? Bang.
Thank you both. Simon Stringer, Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, currently on long service leave. Just one thing I've read recently, an article by David Kilcullen, a well-renowned commentator and practitioner from Australia. We know all about the right-wing militias in the US and white supremacists, etc. He talks about there's actually quite a left-wing element to this as well that we never hear about. Just wondering if either of you can comment on this.
So the question is, you know, is there also a similar left-wing, you know, element in the United States? And the answer is yes, there is. I have long been wary of, and I think our understanding of American politics in particular has not been served by the training of our journalist community, because they have been trained to think that there must be both sides to a story, right? And as a result, you know, on issues like climate change, right, where you'll have a consensus of 98%. You know, they will have one proponent and one detractor. And really what they ought to have is 98 proponents and 2 detractors, right? To give some sense of a balance in the community. But we always try to present both sides of the story. And in the result is that for the last 20 years, there's been this narrative that American politics is splitting apart and the left is becoming more radical on the left and the right is becoming more radical on the right. And that's true. But the difference is the degree of shift is completely incomparable, right? The Republican Party, the party of George H.W. Bush, you know, I would still consider myself a George H.W. Bush Republican, no longer exists. Ronald Reagan would never have a chance of getting elected in today's Republican Party. They're just way off the spectrum. Whereas the Democratic Party as a whole in 2016 elected the most conservative of all the candidates in Hillary Clinton. So what radical did they come up with in 2020? Joe Biden, right? You know, so the notion that the Democratic Party is a party of radicals, you know, it just belies the actual facts, right? So yes, there are Antifa, you know, which strangely, you know, anti-fascist doesn't seem to be an overly bad thing to me, but that's largely a construct of the right-wing media to try to build up a bogeyman. When even, you know, the president's own administration recognizes the primary risk and dangers, you know, come from right-wing, you know, extremists. And again, that's not just a U.S. issue, right? You know, if you look at recent ASIO and ACES kind of reports, they suggest that even in Australia, we face far more risk from the far right wing than we do from the far left wing. The difference is it's much easier for us to otherize, you know, Islamic terrorists than it is to otherize, you know, people who tend to look more like us. Yeah, and that's up to the bike keys, you're right. Fair enough.
Robin, would you like to comment on that?
I think one of the interesting things for me, if you look at the U.S. political rhetoric, the, you know, this communist socialist actions and that, you know, Biden will bring in Alexandria or AOC, help me, something Cortez. And, you know, this is terrible. And what they're on healthcare, for example, what this radical, radical proposal is, something like Medicare in Australia. You know, that's this absolute left-wing commie plot. So, I mean, it's funny because when Kim Beazley's up here with us, he's always like, oh, those Democrats are really, really far left. You don't understand. But I don't think so. And you don't argue with Kim and Wynn, believe me, I know.
Very true. I think I saw there was a question over here. Yeah, gentleman over here. And here's the microphone.
Thank you both for a very thorough presentation and rehash of events. That was incredible, so thanks. I suppose it's a two-part question. There was a lot of talk today and in the media about the Electoral College and how relevant it is. And so it seems to be that the Electoral College was established because essentially what you had was 50 different countries when the U.S. kind of formed into one country, whatever it was. It is so different that you ended up having equal votes for every state because they were, you know, the only way that they would come together is that they were 50 different countries. So one thing we didn't discuss today, I suppose, was preferential voting and where you guys stand on that, because it seems that the weighting that each state now no longer has that power is not going to happen. What about preferential voting that would give more equitable voices?
What a lovely idea. Snowball's chance in hell. So back to the Electoral College. So it was, the Constitution was written, you know, at the beginning of when we had 13 original colonies, and the idea was very much to protect states' rights. The U.S. is very much, as most federal systems are, an agreement by the states to cede certain power to the central government, and that which is not stipulated in the Constitution or is not stipulated. So it's, we're only given up this much. And each of them very much wanted to make sure that they had an idea. The Electoral College actually was, at the beginning, in my understanding is, a representative form of government in which people really did vote for electors who then made the decision on who was going to be the president and the vice president. And at the beginning, the president and vice president run together. So usually what happened, what did happen was the person who got the most votes was president, and the person who got second most votes was vice president. You can imagine how well that worked out. So that was changed. And then in the early 1800s, we went to this system whereby there were electors for each major party, and they were more or less bound. You can technically have a faithless elector, and in the past there have been a few who haven't voted the way their states did. Interestingly, the Nebraska and Maine are the only two states that don't have the pluralistic winner takes all. So that's by district, I think. If you look at the maps, the Nate Silver maps and others, there's like a stripes, red and purple or red and blue stripes across Maine and Nebraska usually. But the reality was the other reason that the Electoral College was brought in was as a concession to the southern states, who were afraid of being, even in those days, of being swamped by the higher population in the northern states. In that time, three-fifths of a slave counted as a person for counting the number of electors that a group got, that a state got. And then also you saw things happen, like, for example, so that swath in the middle where I'm from, that flyover country. So Kansas became a state in 1861, Nebraska slightly after that, and South and North Dakota, which really should have been one state. But because they wanted to have, they knew those were Republican at the time, even back then, they made two states so they'd each get two senators, two more electors. Do you have anything to add on that?
I did want to reemphasize. There's so much about my homeland that has to be understood through the prism of race. And the Electoral College is one of those two, right? It was a concern about the southern states being swamped by the population in the north, but also concerned that the majority of the population in the south even then was made up of slaves. And so that's why you got this compromise that for the purposes of the Electoral College, right, each slave would count for as three-fifths of a person, and that helped them post up the population for the number of electors they would get in that process. Now, again, it wasn't just for the Electoral College. That was for the numbers of members of Congress, right? So the congressional districts are allocated not by citizens, because at that time, women and minorities couldn't vote either, right? So this is that difficult problem that the U.S. is going through in terms of the original sin, some of the fundamental problems. I'm actually a little bit more optimistic. The United States is this country that where it's just impossible change, impossible change, impossible change. Then all of a sudden, it'll change quite quickly and quite rapidly. And so you look at attitudes towards homosexuality, attitudes towards gay marriage in the United States, and we approach it in a very different way than did Australia. But it's just at this point, when is the last time you heard that come up as an issue in the 2020 debate? It is a non-issue. Gay marriage is a non-issue, whereas even 4 years ago it was, right? So the U.S. has that potential just to shift quite rapidly. And there's a lot of things happening right now. Individual states like California are setting up nonpartisan electoral commissions to avoid the problems of gerrymandering. The courts have been very actively involved in North Carolina and Pennsylvania, other places, knocking back some of these things. And so I anticipate, and again, I thought Robin did a great job. Her last slide she put up, one of the real agendas there is basically political reforms in the United States. And if you end up with a Democratic House, a Democratic Senate, and a Democratic president, right? The potential of moving forward, fitfully though it may be, on some of those fundamental democratic reforms, I think have some potential. I haven't given up on my homeland. Right now, it just may seem like this horrific place, disease-ridden, can't get over COVID, guns crazy, but there is this tremendous turn going on that I remain optimistic about.
So there's also something really quite interesting called the Federal Something Voter Compact, whereas states which control, I think it's so far 170 or 193 electoral votes, have agreed that as soon as states which represent 270, so the threshold, agree that they will shift so that their electors will be pledged to the person who wins the popular vote nationwide. So that's already out there and being discussed, and it's, you know, all democratically controlled states which have passed it so far. But it's not a new idea. It's really in the works. And then if you look at H.R. 1, that bill that got through the House, which, you know, says, gee, what a novel idea. Election day, people shouldn't have to take leave from their jobs to vote. And, you know, all those sorts of things, that are in that H.R. 1 bill. If that gets passed, that'll change a lot.
Let me add one other thing. I'm sorry, but on the Electoral College, I don't think that's going to be reformed. That's just too embedded, too difficult, require basically small states to vote against their own self-interest. It's not going to happen, right? But I don't think it really matters as much as you think. Those are the rules of the game, right? You know, and Democratic candidates have won successfully on those rules of that game. And I think every year that becomes less and less important. What we're seeing is that, again, through his overt use of racism and fear and breaking every norm, Donald Trump managed to prolong the Republican Party's hold on power for slightly longer than they would have otherwise. But if you look at the rising generation, you know, how many people under 30 do you think identify with the Republican Party right now? Well, but in general,
all
right?
12 of them.
But again, how many people outside the Fox News bubble, right? You know, identify. It's just. I actually think what we're seeing is what we used to call in Iraq dead enders, right? It's basically a death cult where the Republican Party has glommed onto what is now the party of Donald Trump because they have no other options, but they're facing a generational loss of power and influence, and it's going to be big over the course of time. So these issues that we're really focused on right now become less important because, again, I'll give you a specific example. States that are minority majority, you know, Nevada, California, New Mexico, and now my home state of Arizona are gone. Republicans will not touch them again unless they fundamentally revise their approach to politics, right? Virginia in 2008, right, was considered a swing state. It ain't close to being a swing state anymore. It's solid blue. And that creep will continue with demographics. You know, demography is destiny. You know, the United States is marching in that direction. And what we're seeing is that the difficulty of that transition, you know, and so why we may have prolonged it for a while, and there are just horrific machinations going on right now to prolong it a little bit further. The long run destiny of what the United States is and what it looks like, I think, is written. So this is me being optimistic.
Can't top that. We've got time for one more question from the gentleman there. I'm sorry, we'll have to wrap it up.
A different aspect. A lot of the media over here keeps talking about the influence the Chinese have got on the election. A, is there any truth in that? And if so, which side do they want to win?
Yeah, so there really has been almost no Chinese interference in this election or evidence thereof, right? It is an open question as to who they want to win. The Trump campaign would have you believe they want Joe Biden to win, right? But the reality is China, in my view, benefits when the United States is weak and discredited. And I can't think of anybody who has done more to discredit and weaken the United States than Donald Trump. And so while they have suffered in terms of the chaos, and they like stability overall, but, you know, look, the U.S. doesn't need anybody at this point to interfere in its democratic processes. Its own parties have been doing that. The direct interference in terms of 2016 and ongoing today is primarily coming from Russia, not from China. So I just would, you know, they're there, but compared to the other problems we have, they're relatively minor. This gentleman I took a short question there.
Sure.
Please.
Yeah, look, if we do that, and Sue's been here, and if anyone has to race off in a real hurry, I'm just conscious of everyone's time.
And thanks for the opportunity.
So one and Sue.
I just want to go in terms of potential worst case scenario, because I know there's been quite a bit of optimism. Now, with the new Supreme Court justice, right? So worst case scenario, with some of the court challenges we're seeing in terms of voting being made difficult.
Thanks.
Now, if there are challenges and with the change in the Supreme Court, how does that actually play out, you know, if there is a challenge.
And I'm sure both our speakers will keep it quick, so we can squeeze in a couple more, but thanks very much for that question.
Sorry, a challenge to the results of the election?
Yeah, exactly. So worst case scenario, if that does happen, how does that actually play out?
Well, she's in for life, so it doesn't matter who wins. But you mean, will this court... Yeah, obviously, yes. It's going to be more pro-Trump, six of them now. But if Gordon's right, and I pray he is, this is going to be so strong that it's really not, you know, they can take cases all they want. It's not going to make any difference. So I don't think that's an issue. And if you think about the court long term, you know, again, I'm hoping, I mean, it is what it is. She is now in the court. They rammed that through. That's not going to change. I'm hoping that maybe some of the people who are absolutely single issue voters on anti-pro-choice will not feel compelled to turn up to vote. So I'm choosing to see the silver lining in this, because maybe a few people will stay home. And you know, people can change. So who knows what those over time, what those votes will be. In the very short term, you know, my guess is that these challenges to voting restrictions, there's not a very good chance that the court's going to rule against the Republicans in that.
Short answer is nobody knows, right? And you've actually spelled out a worst case scenario, a la, you know, 2000 Gore versus Bush, counting Chads, and that was given the unique role of Florida as the deciding state. There are a few really nightmare scenarios where you'd end up with a 269-269 tie. If that happens, we've actually got a really serious problem in our hand with violence, with, you know, and the court being involved, completely discrediting the other institution. Again, I'm pretty optimistic, but the short answer is there's so many different scenarios that you have to get to that point. Nobody knows, including the court, right? So,
well, just two really quick questions and quick answers, because very special. With Sue in the front here, please.
Thank you both very much. Fantastic presentation with a lot of interesting information, which some of it was new to me. It was terrific. Well done. My quick question is, if Biden gets in, then how quickly is State Department and foreign policy set up going to move to sort of make good some of the rules-based stuff that's been disrupted? I mean, are they going to suddenly say, yeah, the World Health Organization is all right after all? And, you know, how quickly can all that happen?
One, I think it's really important to temper expectations, because as much as a mess as Barack Obama inherited in 2008 and Joe Biden then as vice president, it's way bigger than that right now. The State Department has been completely gutted in terms of, you know, skilled foreign service officers' ability to do that. And Joe Biden is going to, day one, inherit a raging pandemic with no strategy and almost no effort to stop it. So his first priority will be COVID. His second priority would be COVID. His third priority will be COVID. And then once they get that under control, it'll be economic recovery, economic recovery, economic recovery. So I'm pushing them hard on things like Trans-Pacific Partnership, and every pushback I get back, because I call my friends in Washington all the time, is, yeah, we get it, right? But, you know, we've got to get our own house in order first, right? And so it's going to take some time. There's no question. The U.S. is much depleted. A bit of optimism on that front is that, in contrast to Canberra, where there is a remarkably educated and experienced bureaucracy, the American system is quite different. It is designed to be run by political appointees. There are some 4,000 presidentially appointed, you know, political appointees. About 450 of them are Senate confirmed. Trump never appointed fully half of them. You know, he never had operating it, and right now probably had less than 30% of the Senate confirmed ones are operating. And the good news is the Republican policy establishment is not gone. You know, the Democratic policy establishment is not gone. They're all waiting there, ready to come back and eager. They haven't disappeared, right? And I think there's a real potential for a bipartisan approach to things like you know, the World Health Organization needed reforms on trade, et cetera, where, you know, the Never Trump group, which never joined the Trump administration, will be willing to work together on a bipartisan basis to restore American presence and credibility. But temper that with just the enormity of the task ahead for the Biden administration.
Sorry, Gordon and Robin, I've just promised that young lady there a quick question. So last question. And that's it for questions, but really good questions.
So I had the pleasure of taking part in the Perth US Asia Center's DC program at the beginning of the year, and I made some really great friends, but I've had so many of them message me this week and in the last couple of weeks saying I'm really actually scared what will happen if Biden wins, because they're just really not sure how Trump is going to react and whether he'll, you know, say the election is fraudulent and incite the kind of violence that we saw in Charlottesville. So I just wanted to know your opinion on how you think Trump will handle a Biden win.
Okay, for guys.
Those are real fears and justifiable fears. At the end, he's a bully and a coward. So if he has to go, I think he will go. For me, the real question is going to be, what do the remaining Republican political leaders do? Right. So do they begin to distance themselves, or do they continue to glom onto this death cult? Right. Yeah, and so people like Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio or Senator Cotton, et cetera, even Mitch McConnell, they've already begun to distance themselves. Ben Sasse from Nebraska leaked a tape last week about him being critical of Trump. John Conrad in Texas, you know, made it clear, well, I was always opposed to the wall kind of things. You're like, yeah, right. You know, so the fact that they're already beginning to distance themselves, it all really comes down to the clarity and the scale of the victory. If it's close and disputed, that risk and that danger goes through the roof. If it's sweeping, then I'm much less concerned.
Robin,
do you agree?
I am worried. I'm shocked every time I go home at the more and more open gun carrying. What has become the norm is just very different from what I experienced growing up. I always give the example, my father was in a nursing home 5 years ago, and they had a no gun sign. A sign with a pistol on the door to go into the nursing home, a pistol with a red line across it, no guns. Now, different nursing home, it says no open carry. So in this place where you know people are senile, it's okay to have guns that are hidden. You know, I just, it's hard for me to imagine. That said, I totally agree with what Gordon said. This has to be a definitive statement, and the leadership, you know, has to make even Trump understand nobody's with you on this. And I think, you know, in terms of will he move out of the White House, all that sort of stuff, I'm not worried about that. I am worried about violence or intimidation at the polls. And I'm to some degree worried about bluffing and posturing after the election. Sorry, I don't have a clear out. But yeah, while we were sitting here, you know, Gordon's point about how the Democrats don't want anybody to think that it's given up. So just since midnight tonight, I've got in my emails, Team Diane, Boebert's latest quote is disgusting. That's a Democratic House of Representatives. Amy McGraw, we're in a real bit of a situation here. Kamala Harris, one of the last times I'll ask for $100. Nate Silver says 73% chance. Kate Roberts, Nate Silver just said something big. 1 week left. I must have 22 emails just in the last, since midnight, saying, A, don't quit giving money, and do turn up and vote. So they're not giving up.
Well, look, it is an election. And we should celebrate that, and we really celebrate the fact that you two have given us the benefit of your views tonight. I wonder if I could ask my colleague Brendan Augustin, newly elected to the or appointed to the committee, because it was here we go. So Brendan,
thank you.
As a vote of thanks.
Great. Firstly, I think I speak on behalf of all of us. That's been a fantastically rich discussion. We had two very different perspectives. Robin, you know, reminded me, as much as a geek I am and I've seen many maps, you've shown me more maps. And no matter how many podcasts I've listened to, and I hear Nate Silver in my dreams, you've illuminated us with more factoids and more angles at looking at how this thing might pan out. And of course, Gordon, with your incisive look at, you know, the emotion of it all, and how it could play out, and reflecting on your own personal experience has been wonderful to hear. But one thing that both of you mentioned is, you know, you related, I guess, the Trump movement and the movement in the US to Australia, particularly how it is impacting, you know, how people look at race and indigenous issues, and Gordon in particular, you reflected on how far we've come. There is another election that's taking place in the next week. It's in a place called Queensland. It's on Saturday. And one thing I'll ask you, if you're interested in that issue, look at how the preference flows are going to flow, and the preferences that are going to go to One Nation, and how that's going to impact on that election. And that's a bit of a litmus test on the issue you talked about how the Trump effect, that race issue, is playing out here. And so just keep in mind that for political geeks like ourselves, there's more than just one election taking place in the next week. So before I go, I'll do the honors and give you with our customer. I have the pleasure of presenting you with our customary gift.
First to Robin.
Well, thanks, Brendan. Now, look, it's with a great deal of pleasure that I can finalise things today. Everyone's been, thank you for your forbearance if you're in a hurry to leave at 8, but it's such an interesting topic. I really thank our, reiterate what Brendan just said, and on your behalf, thank our speakers. It was just fantastic. But look, if Florida and Pennsylvania go the wrong way, what we're doing, from your perspective, what we're doing on Wednesday the 4th in the morning, as the two states that we'll probably get a result on. We have to get a result on because they count all their votes the right way. We're having a sort of watch-a-thon, and that's the plan. We'll go firm on it tomorrow, but at the university, the varsity bar in Netherlands, people want to come in at sort of 9-ish, 10-ish, 11-ish, 12-ish and watch the election results. And that's the varsity bar, Netherlands. In Netherlands Broadway, so we'll send out an email tomorrow. There aren't many election bashes on the next morning. It is the day after the Melbourne Cup, so you know, people feel like a Bloody Mary or a cheeseburger or whatever it is. But that's the plan. So we'll send out there've been a number of people asking about where we all going to meet. That's the plan, and we'll go firm on that tomorrow. So. Molly, who's not here at the moment, has been working on that. Just finish with a couple of others. There's our next formal event, traditional event, will be here on the 25th of November, Australian Trade in the Post-COVID-19 World, with a very good panel on Australia's trade. And I'm pleased to say on the 10th of December, our traditional Christmas event is the Honourable Stephen Smith. And he'll be talking about, guess what, the US election outcome, implications for the Australia-US alliance and the Indo-Pacific, and then we'll have a few drinks after that. So that's on the 10th of September. Have a look at our website, have a look at our podcasts. If you're not a member and you're interested in international relations, should join. It's a great organisation to join. You've seen a bit of the magic of it tonight. So on your behalf, I'd like to thank yet again our speakers and thank you all for coming. Thank you.